This week in Retronauts, I do the longest intro before the music ever to let you know that the November 12th launch of Anton Blast, as mentioned in this episode, has in fact been delayed till December the 3rd, and I don't even do a joke. Hello and welcome to another episode of the venerable ongoing retro gaming podcast Retronauts. I am Stuart Gipp and I am your presenter for this episode. But don't worry, you'll be hearing a voice besides mine very shortly. A couple of voices, in fact, because this is one of my occasional interview episodes. And in this one, I have gathered together a couple of indie developers who are working on or have been working on separate platformers. I've got Tony Grayson, who's working on Anton Blast, which by the time this comes out will probably not quite be out, and Joseph Cribben, who worked on Grapple Dog and the more recent sequel Grapple Dogs. I wanted to talk to them as well. The reason I wanted to do this is because I'm a fan of both of the games, or all three of the games I should say, but both of those upcoming or just released games, and I sort of wanted to get the word out about them. But I thought it would also be an interesting thing to dig into their developments and receptions and all sorts of different details, and I think it came out quite a lot of fun and quite informative, so hopefully you'll agree. And I won't keep you any longer with any of my silly jokes or anything. I won't get distracted and talk about, like, I don't know, Kirby or anything, although I do love Kirby. I'm especially fond of these games that he's in and his face. I want to kiss it. But enough about me. Let's hear from Tony Grayson of Summit Sphere, working on the now upcoming Anton Blast. Hello. Would you mind introducing yourself to the lovely Naughties, please?
Hi, I'm Tony Grayson. I am the fearless leader at Summit Sphere, which is a not-so-fancy title for studio head. I'm also the game director on Anton Blast and the composer and voice of Anton and other weird creatures in the game.
You're sort of wearing several hats there. I like that. Anton, then. Anton.
Yes,
the boy Anton. Who? This is a sort of slightly philosophical question, I suppose. But who is Anton?
Oh my God! Wow, that is a deep one. Well, at his core, Anton is a little red destruction worker. He's on a death mission to hell to kill Satan after Satan stole his booze, because Satan's more jealous of how red Anton is. You know, that pisses Anton enough for him to grab his little hard hat and his mighty effing hammer and drop all the way down to hell to get it back. And in the process, he's blowing a bunch of stuff up, because of course he is. I would define him as a, not for the ESRB's purposes, but he is a habitual drunk, and he usually just wants to keep to himself. But other than that, I mean, he's a swell fella.
You could hang out with Anton and just crack on and have a great time.
Really, you definitely, it seems,
could. Yeah.
You definitely, so he's a joker.
Right on. So just in his sort of off time when he's not, you know, descending to the netherworld to kill Satan, what sort of thing would you find him? Would he be at the bar? Would he be bowling? I'm just kind of curious about his personality. You know,
I mean, he would be at the bar, but right on. Actually, like, the story is that he's been banned from the bar for not.
I see. That.
So, you know, he's kind of a drifter by nature, a little bit of an hermit, but he actually does reconcile with the bar owner Brulo for the game's story, because Satan's forces have been pissing Brulo off too.
Yeah. An enemy of your enemy, or sort of enemy, air quotes, I guess, is your friend in that respect. Okay, so we're talking about, I should have made this clearer from the off, really, but we're talking about Anton Blast, which is your upcoming sort of platforming, smashing things, killing Satan to recover vast quantities of spirits, inverted commas around spirits there, from Satan. And that's out 12th of November, I want to say, which is pretty soon.
At the time of this recording, barring any, you know, unannounced things, yes, that is the plan.
So that's probably quite an obvious question, but what state is the game in at the moment, like this close to launch? What is happening?
So the game's coming along great. We're really happy with it. Right now, we're in we're kind of in two phases in parallel, is how I would describe it, where the game is very, very, very close to being playable from start to finish. At the same time, we're also kind of double tracking the polish stage of the game, which is really just, I think that's kind of like our calling card, where, you know, even from like the very start, our Kickstarter demo was very, very polished.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're really trying to punch above our weight and make sure that it's kind of a AAA indie experience, is how we've thought about it internally. And so for that reason, you know, we're just kind of looking at it from the perspective of the game has to be 100% polished from top to bottom before we even consider releasing it. And that's kind of the phase that we're in right now, just making sure that all the art's there, finishing up some of the cutscene work. That's it, really.
Yeah, and you say we, obviously, your team, what sort of size team are you working with? Like, what sort of team is it? How sort of close-knit is it?
So our core team is 12, counting my dog.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And, you know, we're scrappy, I think, for the kind of game that we're making. So we've had some extra help as well with some of the stuff like the cutscenes and additional artwork, particularly for things that I think, you know, I had a vision for that I just felt weren't necessarily in our team's wheelhouse. There are some things that are like mixed media, for example, that we weren't able to do internally or just wouldn't have made sense for us to learn how to do that stuff. So there have been a lot of hands that have touched this game, but the core Summit Sphere team is 11.
That's okay. And how long has it been in development for, this one?
So by the time the game comes out, it'll have been a clean 3 years that we've been working on the game directly. It has been in gestation for many years. I want to say like 7 or 8 years. I've wanted to make this specific game. But, you know, we had a lot of sidetracking. We made Anton Ball before this one. Or I made Anton Ball Classic for the Game Jam back in 2019. And then we did Anton Ball Deluxe after that, which wasn't very good. And then now, you know, not now, but a few years ago, we were presented with the opportunity to strike out on our own and make this game. So 3 years of direct work, but many more years of planning.
See, I've got to hold up, because there was something I've been meaning to get around. I've got to get this off my chest. It's not a negative thing necessarily, so don't worry. Now, you say Anton Ball Deluxe, you say wasn't very good.
Yes.
And I've got to confess now, because seriously, it's been eating me up. I reviewed that game for Nintendo Life back in a few years ago. You do remember?
Yes.
And I've been feeling bad about it, because I gave it like a 6, and I'm like, well, this isn't for me, and I think other people will click with this. But it eats it up your soul, doesn't it? you don't want to do that with indies. It's like, oh, God. But the characters, the vibe, I love the vibe, you know? And I couldn't click with the game. And
I think the thing is, like, a game is a game, and ultimately... Yeah. Anton Ball, I think, is in a weird, weird spot, because I will joke about it and say it's not very good. I think that it is good in what it tries to do, but my honest appraisal of that game is that it's a game for a niche of one, really. Like, the core direction was just something that I made for myself, and it kind of got an audience that was substantially larger than that, and I think what happened consequently was that it spread to a lot of people who were expecting, based off of what they heard, to really get into it. And then I think that it was just something that was way more niche fundamentally, because it's like it's a bizarro arcade game, right?
Yeah. Difficult arcade game.
Extremely difficult. And I think if I designed it today, I would approach it from a much more... I think that concept could be much more... I don't want to say mainstream, but I think it could be much more digestible for a general audience. But I still have a lot of respect for it, and I love that game. I think it's just one of those things where it's a little bit like if someone went and published your home movies, right?
Yeah.
you know. So I don't really judge anyone for thinking too harshly toward it.
So sort of going back from that, and I'm sure you get this question a lot, but like you started with Game Maker was what sort of switched you on to making games. That's not a very good sentence. But so what were you making just like for yourself, like back in the day? What sort of games were you sort of turning out?
Yeah, man. So like I made no secret of this. And I think this is something that we've even yapped about like on Twitter before. But like Crash Bandicoot was like the one for me, right? So like everything, genuinely, I mean this, I want this to be like tattooed on my chest, scream from the rooftops. I would not be where I am without Crash Bandicoot. So when I got into Game Maker, I think I might have straight up just like Google searched like Game Maker, not even like because I need a program, just I wanted to make something. So I had always like drawn up ideas for games when I was quite young, and the very first things I made were like Crash Bandicoot fan games. And I don't remember if I finished many of those, but like I would make them and dump them onto, you know, like the Crash forums that I was on at the time. And I would get, you know, torn apart because I was just a brat, you know, making crappy games in Game Maker. But we all were, you know, like there was the community around that. That was the stuff I'd started with. And then short after, I started to just really come up with like ideas for like original games. And they were almost always 2D platformers, which I guess is probably not a surprise. And then I had actually come up with stuff that was like before Anton was Anton, like they were games about Anton. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Before he had a name or anything, and he didn't look nearly as cool or good as he does now. But it was like the core concept. It's like this is a Red Captain Haddock, and so that for better or worse, that character has been around for the better part of like 16 years.
And so the character's origins just sort of stem out of this, or was this someone, like, did you draw comics, or did you, like, do anything along those lines, or was it just always games?
I think it was always games, like, that was, like, always what it was meant to be, right? Because I think the world, especially surrounding it, didn't really get fleshed out for a long time, and I didn't, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so it's kind of, I need a protagonist, let's make up a guy. Oh,
pretty much. Like I think the big thing, and this mentality has kind of stuck around to, you know, my current years, and it's something that's it's kind of spread across the team in general, but we're a lot more disciplined about it now. But at the time, especially, I didn't take it even a little bit seriously. So I was just like, all right, here's Red Guy, and here's here's like his faithful companion who's, you know, I don't know, he's called Asshole or something, whatever. Yeah. And so it was just whoever that was around. So there was no real lore. There was nothing. And the point of the game, and I guess this still is the point, but the point of the game really was to make you laugh. So it was just whatever dumb thing I'd remembered from earlier that day and just slammed in there, which is exactly how I make games now. Yeah. And these days, to thread that needle, these days now we do take into consideration lore, how things connect with one another. So there is still stuff to latch onto, but so much of it just comes down to, this would be funny.
Now, for me personally, I feel like it's interesting because, not to go on about me, obviously, but just today I was looking through some old sort of documents, some old files. And do you remember the, I don't want to dead name them, the Jumper and Jumper 2, the platform games? They were Game Maker, I think. Or Macromedia, possibly Fusion, but basically they were games that shipped with a level editor, sort of early, quite popular indies before the sort of indies scene, air quotes again, came about. And I was looking through and finding just like this graveyard of half finished levels, and I'm sort of going through some of them and thinking, this isn't. I'm not half bad at this. Like, I just feel like for anyone sort of creating, there's always this graveyard of half done things, and it never. Oh, and you're always like, oh, I'll come back to this, and you never do. And I don't know. Just with Anton, to sort of make an abrupt change back to Anton. I feel like the character is the first thing that I saw, and he would pop up online, and I didn't really know who he was. because he caught on. Like the guy is popular.
Yeah, he is.
was that something that, because I mean, did Anton Ball Deluxe like cross over with Anton Blast? Like, were you working on the both at the same time, or did the character kind of come out from Anton Ball and that fed into the popularity of Anton Blast, like pre-release, or was it all from like Blast? Is that a difficult question? But I think you know what I mean. Like, yeah. Is the character came first? You know, the character or the game in terms of the popularity.
Right. So I think the easiest way to answer that would be I always was seeding doing like a Wario Land type thing.
Yeah.
Right. I was always seeding that, always prototyping stuff, but I never really shared much. Originally, when we were working on Anton Ball, we were meant to do a sort of DK94 style platformer to go with it. And that's why actually there's a lot of weird quirks about how Anton controls. Because in that game, the main mode was not meant to be, you know, the ball part. It was meant to be a platformer. So that's why the controls are just so strange in that game. Because we didn't really have ample time to, like, retool anything. And we were just, you know, like, oh, let's make the game weird. Sure. But Anton Ball was, like, the first, like, public front-facing thing. So I think the characters of the game, I want to say, like, plural, because Annie was really the breakaway hit, right? But I think the characters of the game really caught on and people would draw them. And it was also just funny for people to say Anton Ball. Like, that's a funny name.
It is, yeah.
So I want to say that the popularity, in quotes, of Anton Ball Deluxe was what allowed us to really, like, make Anton Blast into what it was. Because after that game came out, people were like, well, I don't really like this gameplay too much, but you guys really have that feel down of like the GBA, like the Wario Land thing. You know, it'd be really cool if you guys did a platformer. And at that point, it just kind of felt like, oh, well, we can answer that call. Sure.
So Anton Blast was funded on Kickstarter in, what, 3 days?
Yeah.
So forgive me if my numbers are wrong, but I think you had something like a 75k an original, like, God, the word has completely left my brain. The amount of money what you wanted to do the game.
Yeah.
But then it was up to 145,000 or so. Now, I'm very ignorant of this. I mean, is that enough to fund? Is this like a full-time thing, or are you? I'm just curious.
So the best way to answer your question would be, because that's kind of like a two-part question, right? Like, is that enough?
Yeah.
And is this a full-time thing? I'll answer the second question first. Is this a full-time thing? Yes, it is. I am a working professional, and all of our team are. Like, we all do this full-time, and it's our primary gig. As for if $75,000 is enough to make a video game of Anton Blast scale, hell no.
Yeah.
No.
This is why I asked, because I think based on the limited amount that I know, it seemed like as Kickstarter goals go, it seemed reasonable. You know, it seemed quite low.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of those things where, for us, we looked at it from the perspective of what would be a sizable amount of money where we can make the game that we've promised in this Kickstarter, which for $75,000 was 9 levels, right? So basically, like, the original demo was like 1 level of Boiler City, so 8 more of those. Can we do that for 75K if we, you know, take on other jobs or whatever? Yes, we can. That was viable. Not as like a full-time thing, working on that project full-time, but that was viable. When we got to the higher stretch goals, which were having Annie as a playable character and also having 3 more levels, so it was 12 levels total, and that's not including like the bosses and all that stuff.
Yeah.
When we got to that point, we were like, okay, well, that's about 125K, and at that point, now we have to seriously consider bringing in external funding so we can actually do this full time.
Yeah.
And we did secure that in the end, and we've had a very pleasant and independent deal with Joystick Ventures, who are our financial partners. But it is interesting to go back to that conversation, because I think Kickstarter poisoned the well for a lot of people, because 75K, I think, sounds like... That's like the perfect area in my mind for a Kickstarter, because it sounds like a reasonable enough amount of money that you could make at least a reasonable portion of the game for that. And it doesn't also, it doesn't sound too expensive for people. But then you see some Kickstarters where people will go, we funded our game in a day. And then you look and their goal is like $5,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
it's like,
you know, you're not making anything for that. You're making 2 months rent. So I think on the other side of that, you have Kickstarters where the goal is like $500,000. And that's closer to what a game of this scope takes to make. But no one's going to invest in that from a Kickstarter level because it's the well has been poisoned such that people are like, well, that's too much. You're greedy. You don't, you know, you don't need that kind of money. I always think of that one game that one of the ex-Sonic Mania devs had made. I forgot what the game was called, and it, but I played the demo and it was fantastic. But because they were asking for a reasonable amount of money to make the game, the Kickstarter failed miserably.
Hmm.
You know, it's unfortunate, but that's the nature of the business.
And so with Kickstarter, I mean, obviously, you know, it's a funding platform, but it's also like a marketing platform. And this seems to be a very, my understanding is it's you're self-publishing this one. I mean, obviously you have the partner, but it's self-published. So you're doing your own like marketing here. So I'm just curious how you've gone about that, because I mean, obviously it seems to be, you know, working with the amount of engagement, at least fan art and excitement for this game that's coming over. But, you know, I'm in the dark. I don't want to say that and then be like, not, that's not how you perceive it. I'm just curious, really.
I mean, I think from the inside, I always think it could be more, right? I always think it could be more. And I think just like that level of hunger is probably why we've done relatively well for ourselves. For me, I always tend to think of it as no one really cares, or, you know, everyone's going to forget when the game comes out. And it's funny because anytime I relay those concerns to, you know, other people, other friends, other industry partners, they're like, what, are you crazy? So I think at least maintaining that sensibility toward it is good, because you're always kind of fighting to get people to notice. With respect to the marketing approach, so Joystick has been very hands-off in terms of, you know, like you guys were already doing well before us, so just keep doing what you're doing and we'll give you the resources to do it better. And what we've been doing, this is not something that's particularly well-known about me, but before I was doing Anton Ball and Summit Sphere, although I guess it was on the start of Summit Sphere as a studio, because that was like 2018, but one of the things I did as just a sort of hobby was I was actually responsible for the Save Medieval Resurrect Fortescue campaign.
In like
2016, I think it was. It was 2016 or 2017. And that actually got like official acknowledgement from, at the time, head of Sony, Sean Layden. And because of that, and because of just the approach of like doing a grassroots campaign for something that decidedly is not like indie per se, like it was like lower echelon of Sony stuff, but I had to sort of learn like imitation AAA marketing, right? Just sort of like on the fly. And eventually that turned into like semi-official working with Sony, where we had done some press stuff for them, we did some review stuff for them, we I then ended up doing some like under the table community management for them, not in any like official capacity, in the sense that, like, you know, I'm not in the credits or anything, unfortunately.
This is for the remake for the PS4 Medieval.
And because of that, I got a very good sense of timing for, you know, if you do like a big drop, right, that becomes immediately way more exciting if you like seed something and then make it out like it's a big deal, versus, oh, you know, Screenshot Saturday are Indie Dev Hour or whatever, you know, like that. Because it's so easy to get lost in the noise. And so when we announced Anton Blast, we actually announced the game with the Kickstarter, like at the same time. And we had just seeded it before, like because we had a little bit of a following for Anton Ball, not a massive one, but enough that we could say, hey, we're doing game two, and here's a striking silhouette poster. You know, get excited for this date. And so that mentality just kind of stuck with us. And we've experimented with other things. Like, we tried being funny on Twitter. We've tried doing that stuff. I think everyone does it. Everyone wants to be, you know, the next Agar Crab, right? And they're darlings, by the way. They're great friends. But so I don't mean that disparagingly, but more just like with us, we found more success in just not trying to be as funny as our game is generally where we've been. So we treat it like it's a cool thing because in our mind it is.
So I'll ask one more question about the sort of marketing aspect, and then I'm going to ask more about the mechanics of the game, because people want to hear about that. But within the parameters, obviously, of what you can tell me about it, I'm just curious if you've noticed how things have changed at all since the Nintendo Indie World Showcase, where it was sort of a headliner for that. Oh, and that must have been a big deal. Like, that's to get into a Nintendo Direct, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, not even essentially, it is a Nintendo Direct. I don't know why I qualified it like that.
Yeah. I mean, Nintendo have been amazing partners to us. You know, we've been working with them for a while. The game was slated to come out on Switch before it was even announced. And so we brought it to them, and they were excited about it. And I think when the opportunity came for us to be on Indie World, and you know, we worked really hard on getting that trailer together and it finally dropped, we were already moving at a pretty good clip, I felt. But being in an Indie World and announcing the release date there, which was probably the absolute best way we could have possibly done it.
Yeah.
It made tons of people super excited about it. People who were on the fence about the game before, because there's always people who are going to be detractors. There's always people who are going to be comparing it to other games, whether that's like Wario Land or Pizza Tower or whatever. And it's weird because I love all that stuff, and I'm friends with the Pizza Tower developers. So you know, there's no actual beef or anything there.
But, no, I find that, like, if you don't mind me interjecting real quick,
For sure.
Pizza Tower is a fantastic game. It's very enjoyable. The Anton Blast, from the demos that I've played, and I think I've played one that's different from the public demo and the former public demo, and I just don't see it. It just they're not the same. Like, it's I mean, if you want to say this is like Wario, I mean, it's like, I mean, Pizza Tower, you know, you don't break through blocks, really. You do move quickly, and there's the timer element, but that's not exclusive to Wario. I just don't get... It's not the same. It baffles me. They're both stylized. It's like, that's the best I can do, really.
The way that I've always looked at it is... there's a couple of different elements, right? Because I think the cartoon comparison is apt, I feel. If you look at stuff like Ren and Stimpy and then, like, Ed, Edd n Eddy, for example... you can see how both of those cartoons took influence from a lot of the same things, right? You know, a lot of like the Bob Clampett or Tex Avery stuff. But what they did with that stuff ended up being vastly different, right? And so there are similarities in the final result, ultimately, because of the fact that there were similar influences. But the result is very different. And I think what I found is that you have people who maybe didn't love Pizza Tower, and then they attached to Anton Blast because that's a game that does things in a different way that's maybe more catered to them. Or the inverse, or the best case scenario is you see people who love both. And, you know, for me, Anton Blast is a game that's made more to my sensibilities. Pizza Tower, respectfully, and I've said this to developers, but respectfully, like, it does a lot of things that for me just don't really jive with me as a player. And I think that's really just the best thing, is that we're able to coexist and do things differently. I think the comparisons are valid because ultimately they are both drawing from a game that up to this point, before both of us were doing these things, people really weren't even looking at for reference or, you know, making we'll call them clones, or more generously, inspired.
Wario Land 4 specifically, we're talking about here.
With the timer and all that, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I think because of that, and because of the fact that we're also, again, in different ways, we're both doing very cartoony styles, which is something that hasn't been seen, like, even in the indie space too much. Like, there's like a very specific, like, indie style, right?
Yes.
And I think because of the fact that Pete's Tower and Anton Blast, in different ways, are very, like, rough and tumble, you know, 90s, 2000s cartoon. I don't want to say gross out, but it's, like, in that range.
Intense, I guess I would say.
Yeah, intense is the word. I think because of that, people naturally will draw the comparisons. And so I don't mind them, because I know that what we're doing is great. And
yeah.
I think there are worse things to do than be compared to a game that I assume has sold millions of copies.
Yeah, a game that a lot of people have taken to heart, which is a good thing. So, getting on the game now, after 30 minutes of me asking you about marketing, sorry about that. So, what can Anton Blast? What can Anton and Annie? What can they do? What's their sort of? What are their moves in this game?
So you have your typical platformer move set. I mean, it's a 2D platformer at its core. Yep. So you can move from left to right. You can jump. You can crawl on the ground if you really want to. I don't really like to do that myself. But then they also have Anton has his mighty effing hammer, and Annie has her massive mace. There's a contraction for goddamn in there, but I don't actually know how we pronounce that. Right. They have those, and really, like, the primary driver of the game is just destruction, right? So
you can
press the attack button, and then that will just drive you forward in a sort of Wario-style bash. We call it the clutch. And if you do that into an enemy or a brick or whatever, then Anton or Annie will just smash them away, right? But the cool thing about that is that we actually have a sort of, I've always kind of described this as a sort of Crash Team Racing layer.
I was gonna mention that, because that's what came to mind for me when I found this thing. Yes.
Yeah, there's that weird Crash Team Racing layer where when you hit the clutch button, there's a bar that fills up in the bottom right. And when that bar fills up and turns red, if you time the clutch button again, then you can do a clutch boost and start moving faster, and it just stacks and stacks and stacks. And it's something that kind of just came about as a result of the game, for my money, because, like, Wario Land had the, like, 4 and on, I think, or it might have just been 4. Shake It didn't have this, actually. But Wario Land 4 had the sort of R dash, right, where you hold down and you can move really fast, and then that breaks through blocks and whatever. And Pete's Tower went and very well iterated on that. They had, you know, made it have different tiers and all that. And we had made a deliberate decision to not have that move in the game. I think ultimately it just kind of came down to, like, core differentiator. And it, in Wario Land 4 particularly, I felt that that move was just too removed from the rest of the kit. So I really racked my brain, like, how can we add, like, another layer to this that'll make the game more fun? And the natural thing was to just look at Crash Bandicoot, of course.
Yeah.
And I realized, like, there wasn't really anyone who was doing, like, kart racer platformer too much. Like, that's something that was just untapped, and I thought, well, this would be something that would be fun, because I feel like the nature of just tapping a button is really easily understood by people.
Yeah.
And so we just added that in, and then it kind of became this thing of, well, can we add other interactions that come with that? What happens if you just go faster and faster and faster? And then other things came from that, where, like, oh, what if you tap the button again when you're about to touch an enemy or a brick? Well, then you can slingshot through the enemy or brick and get, like, a burst of speed that way. And so what happened with that was we made a conscious decision to make sure that you never, ever had to do any of this.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. So this is because the game, it seems like it's operating on sort of consciously a friendly level in which you're not it's not necessary to clutch throughout the game.
No.
But if you're playing sort of higher level for speedruns and such, that's when it comes into play. It's a mechanic that you can, if you want to, ignore.
Precisely.
I love stuff like that. It just makes it so much more accessible when that stuff is sort of on the periphery. Not to say it's not important, obviously. It's there and you can use it if you want to, but it's not going to harm the game experience if you don't use it.
Exactly. There's like a whole meta game there, you know?
Yeah. And you've also got to move, where you, I mean, I sort of think of it as sort of an inverted sort of hammer whirl from Sonic Advance, where you hit the hammer into the ground and use it sort of as propulsion to get to a higher sort of higher ledges and things.
Yeah, the vault.
The hammer vault. That's, yeah.
Yeah. And that one is really, really fun, where if you press the clutch button while in the air, then Anton will just swing his hammer out. And when he hits the ground, he will just bounce up higher. And it's such a small thing, but just having that very violent vertical ascension, it adds a lot to the game in the sense that the way all the moves chain together means that players can be very expressive in how they play. Like, I think that's kind of a buzzword that a lot of my 3D platformer friends have been using lately, where it's like, oh, let's do an expressive platformer. And it wasn't necessarily deliberate that we did that, but it did end up becoming very interesting to watch people play the game in very different ways. And because of that, as players get better at the game and they become more confident, like Anton's he's got a very weird move kit, right?
Yeah.
And I think when you watch people play for the first time, sometimes they bounce off of it a little bit because they're like, oh, he moves really fast, or, you know, he feels like he's going to launch off at any moment. But as they start off playing and they're very sheepish and then they become better and better and become more confident, it's very funny to watch players become really aggressive in how they play, where you'll see them do, like, my favorite chain is to do clutch boost, baseball slide, jump, hammer vault, bounce. Like, just that sort of liquid feel between the moment to moment is just, it's really just great. Like, I try not to be self-aggrandizing, but that part of the game is just phenomenal. I'm very happy about it.
But a lot of work must go into, you know, and not just, like, obviously the visuals and the actual sort of code, but making it sound destructive, because there's some great sound effects in this game. The hammer vault's just, like, that sort of quite Mega Drive-ish kind of whop-whop-whop sound when you're in the air, which I love.
For sure. I mean,
so what is, like, the progression of the game? Like, some sort of start to finish of a level, like, what is the aim? What are you doing?
Right. So it's all very simple, really. So, of course, as stated earlier, like, the goal of the game overall is to get your spirits back. Now, Anton also is what we call a destruction worker, and Brule the bartender has put him up to going over to the lots that he owns and blowing them up to rid them of satanic presence. So your goal is twofold. You get in, you grab your spirit, and then you hit the spirit timer and get out before happy hour ends, right? And
that's when everything
blows up. So throughout the levels, they are semi-linear for the most part, barring a few left turns throughout the game, which are some of my favorite levels, by the way, the absolute weirdo ones. We haven't really talked about at all up to this point. But throughout most of the levels, they're a relatively linear progression, but they still maintain that sort of Wario Land deal where they are a little bit Metroidvania maze-like. And so to get to the spirit and get to the timer, usually that's a pretty straightforward process, but we have a bunch of other collectibles throughout the levels as well. We have the cassette tapes, which if you have played Wario Land 4, they're very... much an analog to the CDs from that game, where you can listen to the sound room and they're just like awful soundscapes, right?
Do you get little sort of potted music videos with unusual visuals as well? I have to ask.
We have album art for each track, and then we have a weird little guy who is just called Weird Guy. I animated him and he dances to the music whenever you put it on. And it's really, really great. It's very unsettling and very scary. I look forward to my nephew playing through it. But We also have Annie's trash, because Annie's kind of a fail girl, and so she's when all of Anton's spirits were stolen by Satan, they had also stolen her hoard of just knicks and knacks and garbage that was in her apartment. And she's determined to get that back. That's kind of her primary motivator, besides just wanting to blow things up. And so we have those throughout the level for you to find as well. And then we also have spray cans. So we have different skins that the player can throw on for Anton and Annie, and they are individualized between the two, despite them sharing a palette.
Yeah.
And so those are available to find throughout the level as well. And they're extremely fun because when you grab the spray can, it sprays all over you. So you actually do play throughout the rest of the level with that skin enabled.
So do you choose between Anton and Annie, or do they sort of alternate stages? Are the stages different for each character? Or
You can swap between them, between levels. Play functionally exactly the same. So it really just kind of came down to the fact that people liked Annie. And
yeah, so it's a sort of Crash and Coco in Crash 4 kind of deal.
Very much so. Yeah. It really just comes down to who you like more. Like, there was debate internally over if they should play differently between one another, but they are designed in such a way that they are meant to be, you know,
clonables. So is Anton, if you're in a stage as Anton, you can collect one of Annie's tchotchkes, or does it have to be her to collect her stuff?
No, you could play the whole game 100% as Anton if you wanted to.
Perfect.
We the game has sizable 100% completion just because we do have that Crash Bandicoot DNA.
Good.
Like, we're all...
Hopefully not as sizable as Crash 4, but yeah.
No. And nowhere near close to that. I would say it's most comparable to 2 in the sense that, well, it is a little bit like Warped in the sense that we have time trials the like. But we... really, in my mind, have it quite reasonable. You know, we're not...
Yeah.
You can definitely dig a few hours to go in there and just 100% the game, but it's not something where, like, okay, you have to go and collect, you know, 12 gems per level and then do it again. You know, we're not doing that.
Okay, this is all very encouraging. So let me ask. I mean, if you can talk about them, can you tell us about like the boss battles in the game?
Oh my god, they are phenomenal. We are so deeply excited about them. So the boss battles are split into 2 tiers, and we very deliberately buried this during the early marketing. We have what we call the Bucket Brigade. They're the boss busters. They are the big. The big moles that Satan kind of has as his like Fab Four, right? And throughout the game, you know, Satan's forces are not exclusively demons. Sometimes they are just like these weird moles that we call ball busters. And that name just came from when they were in Anton Ball, and you know, it was funny. And now it's just kind of a non sequitur, but it's still funny. The boss busters are more or less them, but they're like the supercharged, you know, they're the boss busters that everyone wants to be, right?
Yeah.
So we have brawl busters, kind of like a Hulk Hogan type. We have mall buster, who she's a thespian at heart, so she loves to sing. And she's kind of like the matriarch of the four. We have tall buster, who's this long noodly stoner, and then we have small buster, who's extremely small and wears a teacup for her helmet, but also she and Tall Buster are, you know, they're always doing something together. You know, they're we ship them internally. And so their fights are very close to being like a traditional platformer boss fight. Although I would say platformer bosses usually kind of suck. They're usually not very good. I hate to say.
Yeah, I mean, if I can interject. Again,
yes.
I often feel like boss battles in platform games should be a reward for finishing a level or for finishing a set of levels rather than a something that roadblocks you. This is why I think Sonic did it so well, the Mega Drive Sonic games, because you can take those things apart in like 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Even if you're not that good, if you don't care about getting hit. So that to me is like the platonic ideal. That's my interjection.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely interesting, because I think that also depends on the placement of the boss, right? Because in Sonic, the way that they function is that they are like the end of your act three, right? Like they're not really like a stage unto themselves. They're kind of like, usually, but they're framed in such a way that they are like the cap off, right? They're almost like the cooldown. And so the way we've structured them in our game is that they are levels unto themselves, practically.
Right.
It's a similar structure to how Crash doesn't put their bosses like at the end of like level five in the warp room.
Yeah.
Like time
between the warp rooms. Yeah.
Fight. And so in that respect, I always appreciated that degree of the roadblock for a platformer boss. And so the boss busters are kind of similar to that Crash sort of structure, where the bosses will have, you know, some predetermined patterns, and you have to wait for a weak spot and then hit them back, right?
Mm.
And they're fine and they're good. And I think that they're fun in the sense that they're very cinematic in how they're presented.
Yeah.
And they're challenging, but I wouldn't call them unfair. And that's really what I appreciate about them. And they're engaging, because I think platformer bosses of that ilk tend to be a little boring.
With the crash, of course, they always take place in arenas that are unique as well.
Yes.
You're not just in the same environment you've already been in, which is, I've always thought, is very cool for boss fights. Yeah.
And you learn so much about the boss through that, right? So we've adapted a very similar mentality to our bosses, where, for example, Small Buster's like in a junkyard, and she has these little mechs that she's been tinkering with. And so that all, you know, makes a lot of sense for her. Our Tall Buster, you know, he's in a big, it looks almost like an aquarium. It's very abstract, but he's just in a hot tub chilling out. And that kind of stuff, I feel, is always really fun, because you can take a lot away from the character. But then, and these are the ones that I'm really excited about, but we have the big bosses, and those guys are just, wow, they do not fuck around. They are very Cuphead inspired in the sense that they are extremely large screen filling beasts.
Yeah.
And these guys are just absolute weirdos by definition. We've shown off the Jewel Ghoul, and he's kind of this massive hulking King Diamond fella. Yep. And he's in his underground mine strip club, you know, being the pimp that he is. He's in a zoot suit, and he pulls out his big gun to shoot at you. He does like the Daffy pose when you start fighting him.
Yeah.
What other stuff does he do? Because I designed that fight from top to bottom. I should know that. He has a cigar that he pulls out and blows fire into the arena. So it's all like really, really like heavily cinematic. But the interesting thing about these bosses is that they are structured closer to a Cuphead or a Sonic fight, where you can hit these guys at any time. So you don't have to wait for a weak point. You can just wail on them and clobber them. And so if you're good, then you can be done with them in a matter of seconds, really. And that's the cool thing, because they are pretty brutal bosses by design. But once you learn their patterns and you learn sort of their idiosyncrasies, you end up really being able to take them out quick. And you get rewarded for being cocky. I think the way that JB, who's our producer and the other designer on the game, he has described it a lot as being sort of like a Sekiro deal, which is maybe like a weird thing that people will always bring up, like a Dark Souls, whatever. We're not using it as a selling point. You know, we're not saying putting that in the marketing or whatever, but it is kind of that sort of Souls deal where you will get fucked up a few times to start with, but you do a bit better each time.
Sekiro has the focus on aggression as well, obviously.
Exactly. Like that
aggression rewards you much more than sort of passive blocking and
precisely. Yeah, like I think overall that's just the big theme of the game is we reward aggression.
Yeah.
And then we have the Frieco dragon, who is this big, crazy dragon made out of pachinko balls. And he's just, you know, he's just a freak, as the name says. He's not a pervert. Yeah. I've been very clear about that. But he is a freak. And the cool thing with all the bosses is that they have these, you know, I call them party tricks, where Jubal has this crazy palette mapping to make him look like he's really reflective. And then Frieco Dragon has a lot of Mode 7 scaling going on, particularly in the third phase of the fight, which is we're not showing till launch. But that fight is just... I'll put it to you this way. It's very difficult for sprite games to be impressive in the current year.
Yeah.
But without fail, every single person who has seen that fight has had their jaw drop. Just like, whoa, what is going on? So... really, that's been the big thing for me, is that obviously there's substantive fights in terms of gameplay, and we're extremely proud of that fact, but also they are eye candy. They will freak you out and make you rethink what a pixel platform can do.
I'm very excited to see this. So just a couple more things, really. You composed the soundtrack. Is that in its entirety?
Yes. Top to bottom, that's me.
So could you tell us about sort of the process there and what kind of soundtrack you've created for this game?
Sure. So before I was a game developer professionally, I had done music. And that was what I was trying to do. I was trying to do session work. I was playing in bands. That worked out okay, but... like, the big defining thing for me during that period of my life was just the fact that I played guitar in a really aggressive way that didn't necessarily... it wasn't necessarily, like, the way that other people were doing it. So,
yeah.
Which isn't to be self-aggrandizing, it was just, no. I was stupid. And so, because of that, when I had come into doing the soundtrack for this game and Anton Ball, and I had done some other indie games as well, I always had a lot of respect for, like, classic game soundtracks, whether that was stuff on Game Boy or NES, or obviously the Crash soundtracks were a big influence for me.
Oh, yeah, they're incredible. Yeah.
They are just fantastic. And Josh Mansell is an absolute gem of a person. But when it came time to do this soundtrack, the original approach was to do it in a way that was very GBA authentic. And so that came down to they didn't have like a sound chip on the GBA, it was all done digitally.
Yeah.
Just to kind of really match a sort of like gritty compression, and everything would be MIDI distinctly. And I have like this massive rack of period correct hardware for all the samples, right?
Yeah.
But I had done that for a bit and it was fine, but it just really wasn't landing. Like I tend to think of it like a great game can be sold on its music. And if the music is something you would want to listen to, like, outside of the context of the game,
yeah,
then you have a winner, right? And so at some point, I just sort of forgot doing hardware accurate, but I decided to retain the sounds, all the weird, like, I have an emulator Proteus here from 1989, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, using that stuff, using stuff that's period correct, sample CDs from the late 90s, whatever. If you use all that stuff... but then you use modern mixing and mastering, and then you bring on some live guitar or live vocals or whatever, then you have something that's just, it doesn't really quite sound like anything else in terms of production or instrumentation. And so I think that really was a driving factor. And then when you mix that just kind of like with my own influences, where it comes down to, you know, I grew up on a lot of like 60s and 70s rock as like a core foundation, which I don't listen to too much anymore, but like even just having like, oh, I really like, you know, All Along the Watchtower, right? Just having that as like a core influence really influenced just sort of the grooves I chose or my chord progressions. And then you start bringing in like Nine Inch Nails was a big one for me. So half the soundtrack is just ripping off Nine Inch Nails. and then you pick out some other weird stuff like Happy Hour, which had at the time of this recording, it just recently hit 1 million views on YouTube. So the kids are super into this stuff. But that track was super deeply inspired by like the 70s and 80s, like power metal stuff that I was, you know, playing with bands, right? And so if you listen to stuff like, I think it was Kill the King by Rainbow, the riff on Happy Hour is, it's a take on that, right? Like, it's really just trying to not emulate necessarily, but take inspiration from all these weird things that maybe people playing the game don't know, particularly if you were born in 2005.
Yeah.
You don't know what Rainbow is, right?
No.
But you hear Happy Hour and you hear the way that the drums play and the guitar riffs, and you're like, whoa, this is cool. I've never heard anything like this before. And also, like, there's the video game music inspirations as well, where that was kind of like Kill the King meets Multi-Man Melee, right? That and people who know that stuff, they pick up on it and they get excited about it. So it's just this weird hodgepodge of influences. I don't want to say that it has a process because it's just extremely messy and sloppy as I tend to be. But I do think that it ended up being a unique result, even if familiar.
It saddens me to a degree that the kids don't know Rainbow, though. It's a shame. they don't know I Surrender. They don't know All Night Long. It's upsetting. I'm British. I know. I'm Rainbow. I know Paul Rodgers. I'm, you know.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to ask, and I always ask this, so it's totally, and it's totally fine if the answer is no, because I know how it is. But is there anything secret about the game that you've never talked about anywhere else that you can tell me?
I'm trying to think.
I think I asked you this for Debug, actually, and you gave me quite a cryptic answer, so I'm going to for another cryptic answer.
What I could do is I could actually talk about what that is.
Yes, that'd be great.
Yeah, just so in the Debug magazine, I don't remember the exact wording that I used, but I'd said something about lime. And ultimately, what pairs better with a good spirit than a slice of lime, right?
Yeah.
And so one of the very cool things that we have in the game as part of the core campaign, I've mentioned the Crash Team Racing influence, but we have these little arenas that you can play after you beat a, we call our worlds in the hub area branches or wings.
Yeah.
So you have like the West Wing, the East Wing, whatever, because it all takes place in the casino.
Yeah.
And it's all like one seamless hub. So it's not quite like, oh, here's like a different floor, a different world, but like the levels are structured in a way it's like, oh, here's three levels, a boss. When you beat that wing's boss, you get access to what we call lime trials. And if you ever played the crystal challenges in Crash Team Racing, where you have to run around an arena and collect the crystals before time runs out, that is exactly what the lime trial is. And even the music is an homage to those themes. We released the music for that last year, I think, and that was being used at the time for the boss rush. And those modes are just incredibly fun. Oh my god. Like, they're so simple, but with Anton's moveset and the clutch boost and all that stuff, and we actually have, like, speed boosters around there, so you can just to really hammer in the CTR stuff. It's a ton of fun, and I think you're the first person I've ever talked to about it outside of the team. So
I'm very privileged in this respect. Yeah,
it's extremely, extremely exciting.
Well, thanks very much for coming on. I'm really looking forward to the game, as hopefully it's become clear. I really enjoyed playing the demo, and I'm looking forward to the full thing. And I hope it all goes well with the launch. I'm really bad at ending things, so I'm just going to say it's finished now. Goodbye.
Bye, everyone.
Okay, I'm back. It's the middle of the episode, or maybe slightly over the middle. It doesn't matter. Consider this the middle, no matter where it takes place. Now, we've heard from Tony Grayson now about Anton Blast, which is upcoming. Now we're going to hear from Joseph Grimmon of Medallion Games, and that's about Grapple Dogs, the sequel to Grapple Dog, which just came out a couple of weeks ago at the time of me recording this, but will have been out a month or so by the time this goes out. It's a game that I implored to check out, and it's a game I wanted to find out more about. So let's do that together right now. Hello there, and welcome to Retronauts. Would you please introduce yourself to our lovely listeners?
Hi, I'm Joseph Gribbin. I'm a game designer and artist. I made Grapple Dog and the recently released Grapple Dog's Cosmic Canines.
Excellent games they are indeed. I'm going to just put that up front. I did review Grapple Dog for the first one for Nintendo Life, and that was a natural 9. I love that game. It's fantastic. I mean, this is why I wanted to get you on this, because I really like the first one, and with the second one out now, I thought it was a good opportunity. But I think the best place to start would be, was Grapple Dog, was that your first game, or were you working on game making prior to that, like elsewhere?
So, I was like a hobbyist kind of artist and game developer for a long, long time. Then I worked at a company called Nitrome.
Oh, Nitrome. The game where you rotate the box, and that actually explains a lot about some of the art. Yes, okay, all right. I'm putting the dots together here.
Well, so the Nitrome are mostly well known for Flash games back in the day, sort of like the Miniclip era, like Newgrounds, that kind of time, although I don't think they were on either of those services. But they made loads of Flash games. I didn't work there then.
Right.
So whenever I say that, people go, did you work on this from my childhood? And I'm like, I'm not that old. I worked there doing mobile games, because they transitioned off from Flash, because that kind of died off. They were doing mobile titles. And I did a couple of mobile titles there people haven't heard of. I did Rust Bucket and Hop Swap, which was a platformer as well. And then I did some level design for a game called Turn Undead. I did some marketing art for, we published some titles on mobile then. So I did that for a bit. Then I have just been doing art around the industry for a long time. And then, about 5 years ago, I was working on Grapple Dog as kind of like, get this off the ground. And we kind of pitched over to Super Rare and kind of got it going there. I released a bunch of stuff at Nitrome I did Grapple Dog, and I also did a game called Magnabox on my own, which once again nobody's ever heard of, but it's kind of a puzzle game about a magnet.
Right,
I think it's really good. Yeah,
I have to. I'm going to check that out now then, because I have to admit I hadn't heard of Magnabox. The one I was thinking of was called Gunbrick, or Gunbrick Reloaded, or something like that. And that was the one that was jumping into my head. So with the character Pablo, the main character of the original game. Was he around like prior to the game, or was it sort of a case of you've got a game and now you need a sort of protagonist?
So, the development on that one was, like I said, I did Magnabox and that didn't do very well. And so I sort of went like, okay, what do I need for the next game that's going to be, how do I do better than that? Like, what lessons do I learn? One of the big things was Magnabox is it's a very sterile game, very deliberately austere, which I found very freeing. Particularly after my time at Nitrome, because their art style is so, you're adding flavor to everything all the time, and it's exhausting. But on the counter side of that, it means that the game, when you're trying to drum up, attention for it doesn't have a lot of personality. It's not really appealing. So when I was kind of setting out to do Grapple Dog, the two ideas were just like, I need something that's like got lots of personality because I can do that, and you can sort of look at just a little bit of footage or whatever, and it's got a very clear gameplay concept. So the personality was a big aspect of it. And then at the time I had a Labrador named Pablo, and so it just made sense to me. Like, but having a main character that had a lot of personality to it was kind of like very core to the concept of the game. It's just
There's lots of personality to lace throughout the whole thing, even in like the movement, which I appreciated a lot when I played it. I'm going to talk more about the sequel, of course, but I do want to ask you a little bit about the first game as well, just out of curiosity. How did you feel about its sort of reception after it came out? Like, how have you felt about that?
Well, I'm a bit of a perfectionist, so there were a lot of elements to it where I was really kind of like disappointed in a way, because there's this, I think it's a quote from Valve that I've always kind of like thought about a lot, which is like, you only know how to make a game once you've finished making it. So there was a lot of aspects to it where, I was like, I know I could do it better now if I just had another opportunity to kind of take another crack at it. And there's a lot of kind of like people that came away from the game or even bounced off it and just said like, this isn't, I don't like this. And I couldn't help but agree because I was just kind of like, yeah, we should have done that better. At the same time, like the reception was generally like really positive and the people that liked it really liked it. And, you know, having played a bit over the past couple of years, it's like, yeah, this is good. You know, this is a good game.
I'm just trying to imagine not liking it. I can't. Like, it's staggering to me. Like, I feel like these people should be. I don't know what to do. Do something with them. Though. Something. I don't know. I jumped a bit ahead there because there was something else I wanted to ask. Because you mentioned about Super Rare, their publishing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So can I ask how that came about? If you're legally allowed to tell me.
I'm trying to think now. I actually think. Do you know the game Cassette Beasts?
I know of it.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm friends with Jay, who is a guy behind that game, or at least one of the heads on that team. And he knew that Super Rare at the time were looking for to get into publishing games. Also, what had happened is with Grapple Dog. So I worked on it for the total development time at the end was about 3 years.
Wow.
Because I was working on it whilst I was doing, I had a job at one point, I was doing freelance work at another point, and it was just so happened that Super Rare were kind of looking to launch a publishing division while I only had about like 3 months left to go making the game. So it just lined up in the right way where it was like the right project for the kind of budget they wanted.
That's serendipitous. That's good. So Super Rare previously, they were, and probably still, I'm not actually sure, they were putting out like physical editions of games that otherwise wouldn't get physical editions. Is that right?
Yeah, that was their business.
But then they moved they sort of went adjacent into publishing. Yeah. So was this a solo code, and build and everything? Did you make this one yourself, or did you work with anyone else? Because I know Mazalian Games is the sort of developer, but I didn't know who else you'd worked with.
So Medallion Games is, I call it Micro Studio. It's basically just a company to handle my games. I'm the only employee.
That's cool, though.
So the way that we kind of work is we just staff up project to project with freelancers. So on the first game, we had Jazz Mickle doing the music. She's a very talented.
Fantastic soundtrack, yeah.
Yeah, she's amazing. And then we had Damien. And his company called iGame.audio, and they were doing all the sound design. But in terms of like every other aspect of the game, that was me. I did all the programming, art, the writing, the overall design, the level design. So I don't really like, because some people go like, oh, is this solo dev? I don't really like to say that because like loads of other people end up working on it. Not just them, but also like people on the publishing side, the marketing side. So it feels a bit egotistical to just kind of go like it's solo dev. But I end up doing a lot myself.
Yeah. So what you did all the art for the game, for the first game, and presumably the second game as well.
Mm.
So did you was it always like video game art, or did you do anything in art outside of video games, like prior to that, or like illustration or comics or anything along those lines, or was it always just for games?
So I went to university and I studied philosophy.
That explains nothing about Grapple Dog. Grappling then, with physical concepts, I suppose. Yeah, okay.
No, but what I mean to say is like my career trajectory was like I'd always drawn. I'd always sort of been an artist. And like I said, I call myself like a hobbyist game dev for that period where it was just kind of like something that I did, but I never thought that I could ever make a living with. Even my art, like, you know, I love comics, I love animation, but it was always like out of reach for me in terms of career stuff. The Nitrome gig was the first time that somebody had paid me to draw something. And so it was a strange learning experience there to do that. As far as other art, video game art is the only thing I've ever kind of professionally been employed to do.
So, what are your sort of influences in art? Because you mentioned loving comics and animation. I love those things too, and I'm trying to sort of just kind of trick you into telling me things that you like so I can tell you if I like them.
I've been reading a lot of Mike Mignola's Hellboy recently. I love like Will Eisner, old Will Eisner comics and his stuff. His books on like cartoon anatomy and stuff. I've just read to bits. What else? I didn't know I was going to be asked about which comics I like.
I was just curious what sort of fed into to Grapple Dog, if anything, if there's anything specific that you've sort of taken inspiration from, or even other games for the art.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not going to say that there was an inspiration here because I have no idea. I remember when I reviewed it, for some reason I kept going on about Denki because it really reminded me of this Denki game called Go Go Beckham visually. Mostly the way that the gems and stuff looked. I even found myself wondering, is there someone from Denki on this? But the timelines don't add up. So yeah, I apologize if that was an annoying thing to read in the review, because I would stop going on about it.
It's all right. Sometimes weird things happen like that. Recently on the sequel, somebody that reviewed the game was like, oh yeah, because there's a level in it that's kind of noir inspired called Casablanca. And somebody was like, oh, yeah, he just took this idea from this Garfield game from the Genesis. And I had no idea that my terrible pun had just been done like 20 years
before. Yeah, but they did that and it was Garfield caught in the act. But to be honest with you, nobody got that far in the game, so I don't buy it. Like, I absolutely believe without hesitation that you didn't pinch from that horrible game. Nice looking game, but my God, it sucks. Grapple Dog's way better than Garfield caught in the act. Don't worry about that.
Thank you. No, but it's the same thing with Go Go Beckham. I remember reading about it in Nintendo Official Magazine back in the day. Because they rated it quite highly. Because I think, from what I remember, it was some other Japanese game that they had kind of rebranded into David Beckham for the UK release or something like that.
I honestly don't think it was. I think it was a Denki original. I mean, I could be wrong, but I'm almost certain that they just made it themselves because they just loved Mario World and wanted to put David Beckham in it for whatever reason.
I mean, yeah, it's confusing. I'd not really played that. I wasn't really influenced by that. I think I was influenced by, I think I had seen Part-Time UFO, but I hadn't played it.
Oh, yeah, the whole game. Right.
Yeah, because that the double outline kind of style on the art. I don't know. The double outline style was just something like I toyed with for ages. And I think I want to say like Mario and Luigi Superstar Saga was like a huge inspiration for that because it had these very distinctive thick outlines.
Yeah, I can sort of see that now that you mention it. Yeah, this sort of very cartoony look as well. Yeah, that's grand. Yeah.
They use a very different kind of technique to achieve that. They use kind of like aliased outlines. Just because I think the resolution of the Game Boy Advance screen was lower, so you couldn't really double up without losing a lot of kind of space. But yeah, but that was huge. Like when I was a teenager or younger, like when I was on kind of pixel art forums, like doing stuff in the style of Mario and Luigi was a huge thing. So I think that probably had a big influence.
So
I'm just trying to think. Other visual, like Yoshi's Island's a huge one. Mario World. The Sonic Advance games, like huge inspiration. Also, in terms of animation, just like Adventure Time, Steven Universe, a lot of that recent kind of wave of stuff, it's had a big kind of influence on it.
So the original Grapple Dog, that's, I want to say Game Maker or Game Maker 2?
Yeah, at the time it might have been called Game Maker Studio 2. Now it's just Game Maker Studio, but yeah, Game Maker.
And was that the case for Grapple Dogs as well? Same tools, so to speak?
Yep.
I talked to Tony Grayson about Anton Blast in this episode as well, and that's also Game Maker, so it's a double Game Maker episode, but completely by coincidence. That's great. maybe they'll give me some money. No, I'm kidding. So fast forward though. So between following Grapple Dog, I mean, were you immediately working on a second one, or was that something that came about a bit later?
Well, I was thinking about it towards the end, particularly like sometimes when it's that thing about you only know right at the end what you've done wrong. Is sometimes you're sort of like in the last couple of months, and you're like, it's too late to make certain changes. And there were definitely things then where I was like, right, I would do this. And then yeah, the last couple of months of development, I was actively kind of exploring the ideas of like, okay, where could you yeah. take it? I even had, I think at the launch, it wasn't really a party. It was just kind of like, I went over to SuperAir's offices and we pushed the button. But at that, I was kind of talking to them about like, here's what my idea would be. Here's how I think it would go. And at that time, it was basically just like a gun. It was like, we need to add a gun because that's kind of where the gameplay evolves, in my opinion.
And that's where Luna comes in.
Yeah. And then, yeah, I think after that, it was like a couple of months of figuring out the contract. And then, yeah, once that was signed, we kind of got going. So it was a little while after the launch of the first game before we actually kind of entered full development.
Yeah. So was it similar, the process with the second game, or were you working on it sort of full time at this point?
Well, yeah, by the time I was on the second game, yeah, I was full time.
Cool. So Grapple Dogs, like, just broadly speaking, what is it that you do in this game, and what is it that's new in this game from the first one?
So it is a platformer about a dog with a grappling hook. That's the core of Grapple Dog. Mm. In this one, there are two dogs. So there's one, Pablo, who is sort of very physical focused and has these elemental abilities that are kind of these unique power-ups in certain stages. And then there's another dog, Luna, who has a gun and has kind of projectile gameplay. And you will be switching between them throughout the game. It's a kind of collectathon adventure 2D platformer that has lots of bits of all my favorite games. It's got excitement and adventure and cool environments and great music and just, yeah, everything I love into a video game.
And sort of the new mechanic you mentioned already was the gun, which is controlled in a sort of, I sound like calling it twin stick because that implies that you're top down, but like you're aiming with the right stick and firing with the right trigger while you're moving around and also grappling. So it's all very active and dynamic. And that's Luna who uses the gun, and Pablo who, as you say, has the elemental abilities, and also he just beats the crap out of things. he probably wouldn't put it that way, but I've got to ask, is Luna also based on a real dog?
No, sort of, actually. Well, so my girlfriend had a dog called Whisper, but they were an Alaskan Malamute.
Right.
So that was sort of took a bit of the name from that. It was basically, I love Shadow the Hedgehog, I love Sonic Adventure 2, and Sonic Adventure 2 is just like a huge sort of inspiration for this game, and I love the idea of like the dark rival of the main character. That was kind of the jumping off point for it, and combining that with the idea of like projectile gameplay is the next step in kind of what to do with the core of this game.
It's fascinating because, first of all, if you love Shadow the Hedgehog, you must be having a hell of a year. All the Shadow fans are having a great year. Second of all, and this is weirdly personal and irrelevant, so I apologize in advance, but the gameplay of Luna, for me, is... okay, look, I'm going to bore you a bit now, and I apologize. When I was a kid, I loved the Shadow the Hedgehog game on like GameCube. I wouldn't say it's a great game, but I loved it because, you know, Shadow, he's cool. And I always wondered what it would be like if it was on the DS. And I drew up on paper this DS game, and it was pretty much exactly the same as it's like 2D, but you tap the screen where you want to fire. And I'm like, this feels like what Shadow the Hedgehog would have felt like on GBA. Or DS. And it's fascinating that you mentioned that because that really is the first thing my head went to when I started busting caps in this game in Grapple Dogs. So go on.
It's funny you talk about that because like one of the inspirations for this is like when I was a kid, I loved Sonic Adventure 2, but it always disappointed me a little bit that Shadow and Sonic had exactly the same moves.
Yeah.
I always thought like, oh, Shadow should have like his own, because in the story, he's got like all these chaos control abilities. And I was like, oh, he should get his own move set and Sonic could have his own moves that, you know, only he could do. Yeah, and so when I was doing this game, I was like, yeah, they're going to have different moves that like say different things about their personality, and that's fine. I think a lot of people in kind of reviews for this one, like a sticking point for some people has been having to change your brain a little bit to kind of move between the two characters because they do have such different movement stuff. So for me, it's like, oh, okay, that's why Sonic Adventure 2 was like that. But on the other hand, I think like the benefits you get from that versus the cost, you get these two very different characters that have very different feels. I think it's worth it in the end.
I thought that Luna's gameplay a little bit, it reminded me of... did you play Bleed, the 2D indie shooty thingy? It reminded me a tiny bit of that with the air dashing and the firing and stuff. And Bleed is awesome, so anything that even slightly reminds me of Bleed is always good. So you mentioned this as a sort of a collectathon. So could you tell us about like the collectibles and the progression, how that works?
So it's separated out into worlds, and each world has its own type of gem, and there are three gems in every level. And you go into, you go into a stage, you get the three gems, and then those will kind of unlock an area of the overworld for you to kind of like go on to further stages. And there's also like fruit you can collect, which is a kind of currency where you can buy outfits and health upgrades and things. And there's also collectible grappling hooks where you can kind of customize your character and outfits. And there's these hidden duck bands that are kind of ferreted away in really hard to reach spots. So that, yeah, if the collection screen is a bit much. It was at one point in development even more, you know, it was a bit Donkey Kong 64 at one point. But yeah, there's loads to collect. I love a good collection screen with lots of different numbers on it.
Yeah, it's all very satisfying. I mean, Donkey Kong 64 is, I think it's like you want to get a balance between Donkey Kong 64 and say Banjo-Tooie, and I think you've leaned more towards the Banjo-Tooie end, and that's a good thing, I would say.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's interesting to capture that sort of N64-ish feel, although the GBA had a lot of games with collectibles like that, and this has GBA vibes very much so. So yeah. And you've got like these like time trial bonus stages as well in there for each character. And is that just getting you more of the gems or?
So in this one, there's a separate collectible that's like gold medals for
completing
time trials. They're never required for anything. That's kind of like a design philosophy. Is like, I'm not going to make you do time trials because I think it, depending on the type of player you are, you either love it or you just like have no time for it whatsoever. So I deliberately left it in a way where it was like, if you don't want to do time trials, you don't have to. But for the players that really, really enjoy that kind of stuff, that's there.
It's just smart because it's just like, well, it's, I suppose it's like in Crash Bandicoot when that stuff wasn't really required, and when it was pretty low level requirements, just like the silver. But how did, if you don't mind me asking, how was the launch for the new game? How did that go?
it's been pretty disappointing, to be honest.
Dang.
It's been pretty dire on a sales front, and I think pretty poor in terms of the amount of coverage that we were able to get and the reach. But it's reviewed really, really well. The Steam reviews, like the ratio is very high. The reviews we managed to get are all 8 out of 10, 9 out of 10. We finally managed to cross the Metacritic threshold the other day, which is great because that means...
Yeah.
That's good for me because it helps me pitch games in the future and say, you know, hey, I know what I'm doing here. so I'm feeling really positive about the reception in terms of like the quality of the thing we made. And I'm really proud of it, and I'm proud of all the work that everybody who worked on it put into it. But yeah, it's been pretty dire on the sales front and in terms of the kind of reach and the coverage.
If you don't mind me talking about that, do you think what might be any sort of factors in why that was, or is it just one of those things? You know, it seems like there are so many sort of games launching all the time that it must be a nightmare getting the right sort of window.
Yeah, I mean, I could talk about it to a certain extent. So, like a big factor in it is just the amount of stuff that's coming out right now. There's just like lots of great games being released.
Yeah, it's wild couple of months for sure.
Yeah, and that's eating into the kind of like bandwidth of people's time, you know, like Astrobot launched a few weeks before us, and I think people weren't done playing that. But also just attention, you know, if there's other indie games that are coming out around the same time as your indie game, people will talk about one and not talk about the other. And we launched, I think there were two other quite big indie games that launched on the same day. And then also 2 days beforehand, we had I Am Your Beast, which is another really great indie game. And then, yeah, I think there was also the Capcom, Marvel versus Capcom collection came out the same day. So the sheer number of releases is like a huge factor. And I think it's also, there's an element of, you know, I just talked about the amount that I do on these projects, which is, I do all the art and I do all the programming and I do a lot of project management, and I do, particularly on this one, because we had, you know, more people working on it and we had a bigger budget and we had all this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily my responsibility, the marketing and distributing of the game. And I trust that other people are doing that. And sometimes I just feel a bit let down by that aspect of it. But I'm not totally in control of it in that way.
It feels like, I mean, from the outside looking in, obviously, so stop me if I'm saying anything ignorant here, but it seems like sometimes, regardless of any of that, then it just doesn't, for some reason, get seen. I mean, there was a new Zelda out now. I think it's a shame. I'm going to do what I can to boost it myself, because more people should play this game. Did you find that the original game sort of had some legs, or sort of what happened with that one?
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of, you know, if you want to have a sunny outlook on it, that's the thing with the first game is, you know, we had a pretty slow launch as well, but I think what happened with it was just had really good word of mouth. And when it goes on sale, the calculation in a lot of people's heads is, you know, it flips in a way. And they go, like, suddenly it's worth it. And we consistently did really well on sales. And we consistently did, I mean, like, we were on the Steam front page a couple of months ago with the first game. And, you know, that was like the highest number of players we ever had, even higher than the launch of the game. You know, it was like really big.
Oh, wow. That was when I bought it, because I got that double pack. So I had it on Switch from reviewing it, but I didn't have it on Steam. So I think it was like £21 or something in both games, which was probably the best deal I've ever purchased in my entire life.
The thing is with that stuff is because it's on discount, just to kind of like inside baseball it for a second. But when it's on discount, you get less revenue ultimately. So it like doesn't counteract necessarily, but... Yeah, but that kind of happened with the first game, where it just kind of like kept selling. And so, at many points where we kind of thought like, oh, this is tailing off, you know. And even when Grappledog 2 launched, people were telling me like, oh, well, the numbers for Grappledog 1 are really, really good. And I'm like, well, that's great. So there's every chance that, you know, it could have a really long tail. It could keep trucking. If the word of mouth is really good, it could sell. So it's not, you know, it's not done for, but it's really hard to come back from a kind of weak launch, and just all sorts of algorithmic things I don't understand.
I don't think even the ones who produce the algorithm don't understand it.
I just want to reiterate, like, a bit disappointing on the sales end and a bit disappointing in terms of the coverage end, but like, I'm really, really proud of it, and I think it's really good. And
well, you're not that I want to platitudes, but like, you should be proud of it. Like, everyone who did anything for it should be proud of it, because I think it came together really well. So I'm going to say a swear word now. It's fucking good. So I think everyone should play it, which is why I wanted to do this at all. So, you know,
thank you.
I hope you don't mind me asking about the reception. And to be honest, I'd seen you talking about it on Twitter a little bit. So I've been spying on your tweets by you know, following you on there.
I didn't mean for them to be public.
Well, yeah, but I was curious about that because of many factors. Because a lot of, to be frank, a lot of developers don't usually talk about that stuff on Twitter. Which is not to say that you shouldn't have, obviously. But I thought it was interesting, so I thought I'd try and pick your brain on that a bit more. I mean, is it from my perspective, again, as someone who's, I guess, the complete hobbyist as well and doesn't really do anything other than mess around with existing level editors. I've worked on a couple of projects that I've made stages for, and they go out and people stream them on YouTube, people play the games, and I watch people play the levels I've made, and they will find without fail everything I'd not noticed they will stumble across and break. And do you watch like streams or let's plays or whatever of your games, or do you find it sort of excruciating like I do?
Yeah, I do a lot. Yeah. I actually find so we actually had internal playtests, and we had like QA stuff. So I got a lot of footage at certain points of like people playing through the levels. I think what you're talking about is really difficult, and it's like a huge part of level design and design in general. And it's a skill that you know, it's like learning an instrument. You sort of like get better at it and better at it. I think it's like one of the best things you can have as a designer is the ability to put yourself in the player's shoes and start to understand how they're going to see it from their perspective, how they're going to play through it, but also how different types of players are going to play through it, and also where they're going to mess up and where they can go wrong. And then you never catch everything, and then that's why playtesting footage is so good, because you can sort of go like, okay, well, you know, for instance, the player might go left when you want them to go right, and you go like, okay, why did they do that? And you work backwards to kind of like figure that out. I did. When the game, by the time the game launched, I will say, like when I was watching people play it, we'd ironed out a lot of that stuff, so you know, people weren't getting it really wrong. And I did take a bit of perverse joy in watching people play and seeing that they were going like exactly as I had intended them to go through the level every time. There was something quite pleasant about that in a way, where I had design this level, I'd be like, okay, the player's going to think this, 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 and this. And then to watch their reactions and to be like, I got it right. I got exactly where they were going to.
Yeah, when you've got to build a sort of invisible guiding hand, it's really fascinating stuff. It's interesting because for me that when it comes to, again, me amateur, don't make games, just did a few levels here and there. But like, for example, talking about the other game on this episode, Anton Blast, a long, long time ago, I saw one of the early trailers for that game, or maybe the demo, and I just tweeted, like, not like rudely, I don't think, but maybe kind of thoughtlessly, like, these platforms blend in way too much with the background, it's so it doesn't work. And then Tony, his reply, and he's like, yeah, I think I agree with you, actually, we'll do something about that. And I was like, they're watching! Pro is watching, and you're mortified because it's like you're telling them how to suck eggs. You know, it's like, do you sort of keep an eye out for people talking about the game on Twitter and stuff? Like, obviously, there's such thing as you know tags, hashtags, and things, but do you keep an eye out for that stuff, for like, I don't know, patches and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I tell you what. So on the first game, I spent launch day just worrying about things, and I didn't enjoy it. So this time I said to myself, enjoy the launch day, Joe. Like, even if there are bugs, even if there are issues, just try and enjoy the launch and try and like not stress about it until you have to. So I spent the launch day just reading everything everyone was posting and just kind of like searching for Grappledog and seeing like, is anybody playing it? You know, what are people saying? And looking through all the Steam reviews and trying to see all the coverage and the YouTube stuff and just enjoying the little bit of attention there. I think now at this point, I'm like, I don't need to read everything. I do try and keep my finger on the pulse, particularly if there's like a bug that kind of made it through the QA stuff and everybody's talking about it. Or, you know, if there's a bit of feedback that just keeps coming up, like if somebody will be like, I don't like this, I'll be like, oh, well, you know, that's just your opinion, man. But if it's like four or five people in a row that are like, I really don't like this, then I will kind of look at that and I'll be like, oh, is there something we could do about that?
This is what we do on the British Retronauts. We apologize constantly and interrupt constantly. It's just the British way. Did you find anything from the first game that came up in particular that you specifically wanted to like fix or change for Grapple Dogs?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, okay, like the big one, and it's like the number one criticism people to say about the game. I mean, I was at a conference last year and I met one of my maybe heroes is too strong a word, but somebody I really look up to in this industry, Tom from SFB Games, you know, Crow Country, County? I always forget whether it's Country or County.
I actually don't know.
Or they did, what's the
I'm
one?
I'm a horrible journalist.
They did Snipper Clips. They did...
Yes, Snipper Clips, yes. Yeah.
And I met him, and he was very nice about Grappledog, and I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. And then he went to me, what happened with the music? the one criticism we got repeatedly is just like the music was really repetitive. And then that was a big thing that I wanted to fix for this game. But it's also like, that wasn't just a problem with the music, if that makes sense. It was like a problem that pointed to other problems. And I think it pointed to a broader problem, which was like, there wasn't enough environmental variety because you were kind of playing like the mountain world, like six levels in a row. And also that the environments in the first game were quite, maybe this is too negative a phrase, but like bog standard platforming stuff, which I love that stuff, but like...
Iconic. You know, iconic is the word to use.
Iconic. Okay. Yeah, but like, you know...
Everything that sounds bad can be rephrased in the way that makes it sound good.
Oh, wow.
Repetitive music. Catchy music.
Oh, yeah.
I love that game's soundtrack. I loved Grappledog's soundtrack. That guy can swivel as far as I'm concerned. No, I'm kidding.
It's really good, but it does get a little repetitive after a while. But yeah, but that's one of the reasons why like the core concept of the sequel is like you go to all these different worlds and they're all jumbled up in different orders and you know, you're here 1 second and there next because that way you're not listening to the same track so much. And yeah, we definitely worked on like the variety in the soundtrack. And also just like complaints about the physics. I definitely had a look at all that, everything that everybody was saying. I really read through a lot of the Steam reviews. And, you know, if there's people that are like, I don't like platformers, I don't like this game, then there's like not much you can do because it's not the game for you. But
they're like, I don't like platformers. I don't like this game. And I came to write a review on which I should be seen as an authority in some way.
Yeah, but they're... But what got to me was there were people that were like, I really wanted to like this game. I really love platformers. But these couple of things just kind of like got to me. And that kind of stuck out to me. And I was like, yeah, they're kind of right in a way, you know. And so, we set out to fix a lot of that stuff this time around.
Sort of as we're sort of drawing to sort of the end of this chat, do you know what you're doing next? I mean, it's probably something you can't talk about, but generally, do you know what you're going to be doing sort of post Grapple Dogs or in sort of the launch window?
So I am going off to go do a bunch of freelance work. I need to pay my rent, so I'm going to be doing some art for some other people's projects for a bit.
Cool.
And then I've got a couple of irons in the fire in terms of things that might be going here and there. And yeah, I would love to do another Medallion Games production one day. I think now's a pretty bad time on the indie game front just because funding is drying up.
And UFO 50's come out and it's ruined all other indie games forever.
They just did 50 games at once. It's not fair.
It's cheating.
Yeah, but also just like, publishers are getting scared and shutting down. And it's a pretty rough time. So I'm not sure whether another Medallion Games game is going to happen anytime soon. But I'd love to do that eventually. And I've got like a big manila folder full of ideas of things I'd like to make.
Any other sort of genres that you're interested in tackling, or is it going to be platformers all the way down for you, do you think?
I'd love to do Zelda. I've always wanted to do Zelda. That's kind of like my big love.
I think I saw you prototyping something on Twitter, actually, like a top-down kind of engine.
Yeah, it's also like a bucket list thing of like, one day I'll do a Zelda, and I'm increasingly just like, well, I'm not getting younger. I should probably... do that at some point. I'd love to make a stealth game one day. I really love like Splinter Cell, Metal Gear Solid. I'd also love to make a shooter at one point. I think that'd be cool. But yeah, I'd all sorts of genres I'd love to try. Just whether I can, whether I get the opportunity to, I'd love to.
Well, thanks very much for coming on. I have enjoyed talking to you, and I appreciate your sort of candor in general. And I want to urge everyone to buy Grapple Dogs and Grapple Dog. And you know what? I am going to shamelessly show it because it's, like I said earlier, it's fucking good. if you don't buy them, I'm going to come to your house and I'm going to beat the shit out of you.
Okay, that's I don't condone that. As the official representative of Medallion Games, I cannot.
Also, I probably shouldn't say that because I probably could get in trouble. So I just want to retract that. Actually, I'm not going to come. I'm not going to come to your house. I might come near your house and look at you. Like, as you go, come back from work, I'll just be standing there across the room with my arms folded, glaring at you, knowing that you haven't bought it.
Give a weird stare.
Yeah, yeah. And they'll see it's me, and they'll be like, why is world-famous Retronauts presenter Stuart Jitt standing 600 yards from my house and folding his arms and staring at me? No, seriously, I really love them. That's why I wanted you on here, because I'm a fan, and I wanted get the word out, and I want people to play these games, because if you like... I'm trying to think. It's difficult to even say sort of if you like this, like that, because I do think they're quite singular games. But if you like platform games that are concerned with being fun rather than being like punishing, you know, that aren't trying to make you feel like you're just dying constantly, though they do have their challenge. And you want to use a grappling hook that isn't fiddly, and it's easy to use the grappling hook, and it's incredibly accessible. And there are accessibility options as well if you want to just jump infinitely, because you. I don't know why you would want to do that, but you can if you want. You can jump infinitely. And you want to be a cool dog that you can also pet. You can pet the dog, by the way, like the meme. Then, yeah, please get in on this. It's very good. And that's a stewardship guarantee, which is worth an enormous amount of cultural cash, obviously. So thank you very much
for coming on. Thank you for the nice words. That's far too nice.
I can be nicer. I can be desperately nice.
Well, yeah, I'm really, really glad you enjoyed it. And I'm just really glad that it's out there, because I've worked on it for so long and that people are really vibing with it. And it's, everybody who plays it seems to really, really enjoy it and really kind of get what I was kind of going for with it. So, I'm really proud of it. I'm really feeling very positive about it.
I will look forward to Grapple Dog 3 / Now It's Zelda.
Oh, God, I'm trapped making Grapple Dog forever. Yeah.
There's no escape from the hook of Grapple Dog.
I have just one last point. I have joked around that I can never include a grappling hook in a game ever again. I've ruined it for myself.
You've grappled with your own concept too much. I'm going to stop doing grappling puns now. Go and buy the game. It's on Steam. It's on Switch. Is it on an Xbox, PlayStation? I can't remember.
It is on Xbox Series S and X, but not on PlayStation.
Great fit for the Switch, great on Steam. Steam Deck works perfectly. Both of them do, in my experience. Get them in, you'll love them. And again, thanks very much, and perhaps we'll talk again at some point in the future.
Well, thank you for having me. And I loved it.
Right, that was interesting, wasn't it? I'm back. It's me, Stu. I've returned to do the end of the episode. Thank you very, very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I love doing these interviews, and to be perfectly frank, I think I'm getting slightly better at them, so that's always nice. Nice to find a sort of a rapport there, and I think I did. So, yeah, and I will continue to big myself up. But if you want to big us up in the form of money, and by us I mean Retronauts, you can do so by heading over to patreon.com/retronauts, where for just $5 a month you'll receive not just the weekly episodes a whole week in advance, but two additional bonus episodes, full-length bonus episodes per month that you won't hear anywhere else, and you'll be the envy of all your friends and lovers, of which you'll obviously take many, because, you know, they'll know you're a Patreon supporter for Retronauts, and they'll just, they're pants will just fly off. They'll just fly away into the sun, and you'll never see them again. I don't know what I'm talking about sometimes, but as well as those wonderful things in the pants thing, into the sun thing, you'll also be able to get Diamond Fight's tremendous This Week in Retro columns, which are not just written columns, but also delivered in podcast form. They're great as well. I really can't recommend them enough. And you'll also have the eternal gratitude of us here at Retronauts, and you'll have access to our excellent Discord, which you'll, if you're a fan of me saying swear words, you're going to love that Discord, because that's all I do in there constantly, to the point that I'm always just told, Stuart, please stop swearing. It's a family podcast. It isn't, because of me. No, I kid. But thank you, seriously, thank you very much for listening, and there'll be another episode long in just a week's time, so get excited about it.